Well, once again, good morning. Thank you, William. I have a hypothetical question to ask you guys. So suppose you had one rule, and this one rule was not to be broken. Maybe it's for your kids, for your employees, maybe it's in your friend group, your siblings, or your family, something like always show respect, never be late, don't tell lies. For my kids, it's be nice. You know, it's simple, all-encompassing. Just be nice. So when Theo's not being nice, we tell him, Theo, be nice. And then he goes, nice, as he's throwing his brother's Lego truck across the room. So usually these types of rules, they come with some sort of consequence, too. Some sort of punishment. For my kids, if they're not being nice, then they're met with some time in solitary confinement. Just time out in layman's terms. If you're not nice, you go to your room. Fairly simple, yet effective. Well, for the most part. Now let's imagine that in your friend group or your workplace or your family, someone does the unthinkable. Even your spouse, maybe. They break this one rule. They cross the line. What would be better? What would be better? Would it be better to give them a guilty verdict, or would it be better to let it slide? Would it be better to show mercy or judgment? A few years ago at a church Megan and I served at, we took part of the youth budget and we bought, I think it was 24, I can't remember precisely, but I think it was 24 Nerf guns. And not just any Nerf guns, but fast, pretty powerful Nerf guns. In fact, I have one right here, just in case anyone falls asleep. And these, so we bought 24 of these. I just want to show you for a second just how fast they shoot. So unless we have any volunteers, do you have any volunteers? Has anybody got an apple? I can't shoot you. It's probably breaking some COVID regulation. Okay, so everybody watch that. I'm going to shoot the sign up there. So they go pretty good. In fact, I could probably peg Kevin on the sound booth back there if I really wanted to. Yeah, see, pretty good. So they don't shoot Nerf darts. They shoot these nice little balls, and they travel fast. In fact, they recommend that you buy these, like, paintball masks things to wear for safety. But, of course, at the time, I was on a tight budget. So instead, I went to the dollar store and bought a bunch of safety glasses because, you know, safety first. So here we are. We're in this small concrete floor gym about the size of this room, and all 24 of these guns are in the hand of a youth kid. What could go wrong? So I'm standing in the middle, and they're all lined up on one side, and I'm trying to explain the rules to the game. And it wasn't going well. I'd get like three words out of my mouth, and pow, 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 pow. Like just these little yellow Nerf balls were just raining off of my body. So after about 10 minutes of this, I'm not going to lie, I got a little frustrated. I got a little bit mad. You know that feeling when it's just like your cheeks get hot. You know, you're trying to keep your cool, but you're not doing very good at it. So I gave them one rule. I said the next person to shoot their gun outside of the organized game, I would take their gun away and they wouldn't be allowed to participate. Silence. Sweet, beautiful silence. You could hear the sound of a soft Nerf ball drop and hit a concrete floor. It was so quiet. Sweet, glorious silence. So I proceeded to explain the game, all the while basking in the silence and my ability to control this group of hooligans, when all of a sudden, thwap, I got pelted right in the neck, like right in the jugular. Just nailed me. And it took about 2 seconds to figure out who it did. I just looked down the line for the kid that had a look on their face. And it was this girl at the very end. So I was mad. I was ticked right off. I walked right over there. I had one rule. I had one rule. Just don't shoot. And they couldn't even do that. So I walked over. I took her gun away. And I proceeded to explain the game that she would not be a part of. After I finished explaining the game, I took this girl to the side to discuss what had just happened. I mean, I was still pretty mad. I was still fired up. I mean, she shot me in the neck. And it was in front of everybody. And just after I asked them, don't shoot the guns. So I was still mad. And I was lecturing her. And as I was lecturing her and just telling her that we need to have boundaries to, you know, avoid complete chaos, I could just see the look of disappointment on her face, the look of regret. And while I was talking with her, my heart softened. I don't know why, but it did. And so after I finished lecturing her, I returned her gun to her and let her participate in the game. It would have been so easy, even justifiable, to take her gun away, to leave her out of the fun. But for some reason, I felt swayed to demonstrate mercy toward her rather than judgment. So which was better? Was it better that I showed her mercy and let her play anyway? Or would it have been better that I stuck to my guns by keeping hers? What would have been better? And if I asked everyone here, I bet I would get a flurry of different answers. Everyone would have a different idea. Some of you might say, well, mercy was better because you showed her love and kindness. Some might say, well, she broke the rules. There must be consequences for your actions. Otherwise, you're just rewarding her bad behavior. You're just enabling her. And so the arguments would begin. But if we're being honest with ourselves, when it comes to these difficult questions, we don't really look for answers, do we? I'm going to put my slide up. We don't look for answers, we look for arguments. In fact, this is pretty much what our entire culture does. Our culture is steeped in this mentality. We just run to Google and we search for an article or a prominent evangelical author that lines up with the way that we are already thinking, and we use that as ammunition in the war to get our opinions heard. Instead of looking for answers to the questions for issues at hand, we look for arguments to support our opinions, our side of the question. Perhaps the most obvious example of this is politics. It isn't very difficult to see the polarization of the left and the right, is it? The two sides keep getting farther and farther apart. All the while, they just keep talking past each other, peppering the other side with the latest array of arguments. Our culture has set us up to pursue judgment at the expense of mercy. But what if I told you that it were the other way around? Would you believe it? What if I told you that instead of pursuing judgment, we should pursue mercy? Would you agree? What if you were told to show mercy to that employee who shows up 15 minutes to late every day, 15 minutes late to work every day? Would you do it? What if I told you that you should show mercy to that person in your family who is clueless to the way they mistreat you, to the way they make you feel, who seems to be only concerned about themselves? What if you were told to be merciful to that person in your church who seems to be on the opposite side of nearly every topic as you? How would that make you feel? If you're anything like me, it might rub you the wrong way. It might seem like a task too difficult to accomplish. It might even feel unfair. Why should I show them mercy if they don't show me any? And yet we read in James 2:12-13, speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. And then the thought is wrapped up with a short, simple sentence, simple yet almost proverbial, because mercy triumphs over judgment. Mercy triumphs over judgment. It's an easy thing to say, but not an easy thing to do. Especially nowadays in our polarized culture, judgment seems to just flow more naturally than mercy. And yet here in James, we are told to speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. The person who wrote this simple yet profound thought is none other than James, the brother of Jesus. He is the leader of the church in Jerusalem. He was the guy in charge of all the new Christians that were flocking to Jesus. And the first thing we should note about this letter is that James is writing to believers. He's writing to Christians, and more specifically to Jewish Christians. We see this in the introduction of his letter. In James 1:1, he says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. So we have the leader of the Jerusalem church writing to Jerusalem believers who are no longer in Jerusalem. They are scattered among the nations. In other words, they've been dispersed. They've been forced out of Jerusalem. So scholars believe that James is actually writing in response to a specific event that happened. It happened in the book of Acts, Stephen's death, the first martyr. In Acts 8:1, we read that on that day, on the day Stephen was murdered, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. So James was the leader of this church, and the people that were being forced from their homes was his congregation. So it'd be like if a great persecution broke out here in Claire's home, and all of you guys had to flee, you had to leave your home, you had to leave everything and get out, or you would be killed. And then Joseph or myself wrote you guys a letter to encourage you in your circumstances. This is the situation the first century readers of this letter found themselves in. Is it any wonder that James starts his letter off by encouraging his readers to persevere? This is the defining characteristics of the recipients of this letter. They have been dispersed, forced to live outside of their country. They are poor. They are oppressed by wealthy landowners who take advantage of them, drag them into court, and scorn their faith. So I want to ask you a question. If these were your circumstances, how many of us would naturally be merciful? If these were your circumstances, how many of you would naturally be merciful? Put yourself into their shoes, into the shoes of the scattered Jews. You've lost your home, your land, your family. You've been forced to live in a country that is not your own. To work for people who oppress you, they take advantage of you, they don't appreciate you, they exploit you and ridicule your faith. And now imagine that you get this letter in the mail from Joseph or myself, and in this letter we admonish you to be merciful. It almost seems like a slap in the mouth, doesn't it? Like, how dare you? Don't you know what I've been going through? Don't you know how I've been treated? And you want me to show mercy? Nuh-uh. No way. You're crazy. It can't be done. See, the problem is we often think of it from our perspective. We think of how other people need to be merciful to us, but not necessarily the other way around. See, it's easy to have mercy shown to us, or even to demand to have mercy shown to us, but it's not so easy to show mercy to others. We don't want to admit it, but too often, we are the unmerciful servant in Jesus' parable in Matthew 18, who, when the king had forgiven his debt of 10,000 bags of gold and showed him mercy, he went out and found a fellow servant who owed him 100 silver coins, a fraction of what he owed to the king. And when his fellow servant couldn't pay him, he grabbed him, choked him, and threw him into prison. Too often, we beg for mercy and then turn around and administer judgment at the expense of mercy. But this is the big qualifier. This is the big qualifier here. This is the answer to the why question. Why should I show mercy? Why does mercy triumph over judgment? Simply put, because you have already been shown mercy. This is why James can say, speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. I don't know about you, but when I think about a law, I don't necessarily think about freedom. Maybe it's just because I was a hooligan in my younger days. But generally speaking, a law, to me anyways, is a list of things you can't do. It's stuff, I mean, sure, it's for your own good. It's for your own benefit even, but oftentimes it feels like a burden. It's an obligation that almost gets in the way of our freedom. It's like all the COVID-19 regulations. Like, what a burden. The law James is talking about isn't the law of the land. It wasn't Roman law, and it's not the law the RCMP pull you over for breaking, or even Old Testament law, but rather Old Testament law as reinterpreted and fulfilled by Christ. You can see this in verse 8, where James says, if you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. The law that gives freedom is the teachings and life of Jesus that not only reinterpreted the Old Testament, but fulfilled it. You see, God's gracious acceptance of us does not end our obligation to obey him, but rather it sets it on a new footing. No longer is God's law a threatening, confining burden, but an obligation that we live out in joyful knowledge that God has liberated us from sin and given us through his Spirit the power to obey his word. In other words, God has been merciful to us, far more merciful than we can imagine. And so we should be merciful simply because we have been shown mercy. Just as the king showed mercy when he forgave the debt of 10,000 bags of gold in the parable of the unmerciful servant, so has our King, our Father in heaven, forgiven such a debt that we could not pay. And because of this, we are to speak and act as those who have been given such tremendous mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. I do want to make a quick point here that James, he's writing his letter to believers, to people who have already put their hope and trust in God as their Father. So I don't want anyone to think that James is teaching some sort of universalism here. He's not saying that all you got to do to get into heaven is just be merciful. That's not what he's saying. Because he's already writing to people who have put their hope and faith in Christ. The judgment that James is talking about here isn't judgment for determining our eternal destiny, because his readers already have their eternal destiny determined. But rather, it is one of reward for believers. So in essence, what James has done here is he's taken Jesus' beatitude, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy, and he's turned it into its opposite. Cursed are those who are not merciful, for they will not be shown mercy. As a result, the text gives its readers this sense, this feeling that stresses the continuation of action. Even the words speak and act in Greek, they give this feeling that things need to happen. Be constantly speaking, always acting. See, sometimes we think mercy is just a feeling of concern. But James here reminds his readers and us today that mercy is more than a feeling. It involves actively reaching out to show love to others. Mercy isn't a feeling. It's an action. And James tells his readers that this action of mercy triumphs over judgment. And the mercy James is talking about is human mercy. It's not God's mercy toward us. It is the mercy that we are to show to one another. James is making the point that the way we do or do not show mercy to others shows our desire, not our willingness, but our desire to obey the law of the kingdom, giving evidence to a heart made right by God's grace. See, the believer will always deserve God's judgment. We can never perfectly conform to the royal law. We will always fall short. But our merciful attitude, our actions count as evidence to the presence of Christ within us. And it is on the basis of our union with Christ, the one who did perfectly fulfill the law, that we can have confidence of vindication at the judgment. And so I want to ask us a question. Are we actively reaching out to show mercy to others? Are we, as a church, actively looking for ways to do mercy in our community, to do mercy in our church, or are we falling into the traps of our culture? Are we looking for arguments over answers? Are we administering judgment at the expense of mercy? Are we bearing evidence to the work that God's grace has done in our lives when he showed us so much mercy? So the example that James uses in his letter is favoritism, showing special attention to a rich man who walks into their meetings by giving him special attention, all the while making the poor man sit on the floor. And James points out the irony of this situation. He says, come on, guys. Like, these rich people, they're the ones who are taking advantage of you. They're the ones who are exploiting you. They're the ones who are dragging you into court, who are blaspheming the very name to whom you say you belong. And yet they are bending over backwards for the rich, all the while ignoring the poor. And James reminds his readers that it is those who are poor in the eyes of the world who will be rich in faith and inherit the kingdom that Christ promised to those who love him. It is difficult for me to read James's admonition about favoritism and not feel convicted. And I want to tell you guys why. You see, when you are in ministry, and newsflash, we're all in ministry, it's not just me, it's far too easy to fall into the trap of favoritism. Not necessarily in the same way as James describes it, but in another way. See, there are some people who are easy to minister to. Maybe they're already really strong in their faith. They're on a good path already. They give you lots of compliments. Maybe they think the same way as you. They value the same things as you. And so you feel comfortable around them. Maybe you you spend a little more time with them because you get along with them. You show them more attention. And then there's this other group of people, maybe a little different than you. Maybe they don't value the exact same things that you do. Maybe they need just a little bit more work. And maybe they're just not as receptive to your teaching as others. And maybe they just rub you the wrong way. And whenever you spend time with them, you get this feeling that you just don't like. Something that can be summed up in one word: uncomfortable. You just feel uncomfortable, and nobody likes to feel uncomfortable. We like to be comfortable. We run towards things that make us comfortable, and we run away from things that make us uncomfortable. Oftentimes, though, it's the uncomfortable situations. Oftentimes it's the uncomfortable people in our lives that need to experience Jesus' love the most, though, isn't it? And oftentimes it's the uncomfortable situations that God is the most at work in. And you know what? If we really think about it, mercy is uncomfortable, isn't it? Showing mercy to someone who we think just doesn't deserve it is uncomfortable, isn't it? And yet we have a king who came to this earth, lived a life that we could not, completely fulfilled the royal law. Think about that. There was not one moment in Jesus' time here on this earth where he did not value others above himself. He fully fulfilled the royal law, never sinned once. And instead of rubbing it in our noses, instead of showing us judgment, he showed us mercy, truly uncomfortable mercy, by offering up his life with the Father to us. Mercy triumphs over judgment. So are we actively pursuing mercy, or have we become comfortable? So COVID has made things a little bit uncomfortable, hasn't it? I mean, just look at the sanctuary. Chairs awkwardly strewn about. I mean, they're a little more organized now. And it's brought a ton of change, a ton of uncomfortableness. But it has also brought something else. It has brought differing opinions. Everyone has an opinion on what the government should do, on what we as a church should do. And the longer this pandemic goes on, the farther apart all the opinions get, and the more polarized the different sides get. We've stopped looking for answers, and we've started looking for arguments. We've started looking for ammunition to show that our opinion is correct, that we have it all figured out. And if all those other people who disagree with me would just think the same way as me, then we could all get along with doing church. There's a real tension, isn't there? It's really uncomfortable, isn't it? Oftentimes, when we think about this tension, we apply it to everyone else, but not to ourselves. We think to ourselves, man, so-and-so, they really need to hear this. I got it all figured out, but they need this. And if I'm being honest with myself and with all of you, I know that this is where my mind too often goes. If this thought went through your mind, I want you to do something. Take out a pen or a piece of paper or your phone, whatever you take notes on, and I want you to write the names of the people that came to mind down. It could be someone in your church, someone in your community, maybe an extended family member, a coworker. Write down all the names of the people that you think need to be more merciful. And now I want you to shift your mentality. I want you to do something truly uncomfortable. I want you to pray for these people. And more specifically, I want you to pray that you would be merciful towards them. Not that God would soften their heart and change their minds, but that God would soften yours so that you can truly trade judgment for mercy. But don't leave it there. After you pray for them, I want you to actively pursue ways that you can show them mercy this week. Because mercy isn't just a feeling of concern, but it is something that involves actively reaching out to show love to others. So how are you going to show mercy to those people this week? And my brothers and sisters, this shouldn't be something we begrudgingly do. It shouldn't be something that is a burden, but rather something that is evidence to a heart that has been changed by the unfathomable mercy God has shown us, a heart that has been truly transformed and that has been indwelt with the Holy Spirit, who is the one who gives us the power to live in such a way. And if you think to yourself that this is too difficult, to live in such a way is impossible, I can't do this, well then I would like to tell you that you're right. You can't, but God can. Pray and ask for God's Spirit to give you the strength to do it. Become reliant on God, because you know what? God isn't asking you to do something he hasn't done already. Pray and ask his Spirit to give you a heart that truly believes and has experienced that mercy triumphs over judgment. Kevin and the team are going to come and lead us in a closing song. And as you guys sing it, I want you to meditate on how much mercy God has shown you, truly worshiping him for what he has given you. And then walk out this week with his mercy pouring out of your entire being.